You found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show. Current events, newsmakers, lifestyle, health, relationships, entertainment. Miss a day? Download the podcast at LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez Show, and thank you so much for joining us. It's Monday, May 20th, 9 a.m. Pacific time. If you're live, we welcome you. If you are listening on download or on demand, thank you so much for joining us. You can listen live Monday through Friday at latalkradio.com. We're on Channel 2. You can also download free apps so that you can listen on your iPhone or your Android. And you may also listen on iTunes or MariaSanchezShow.com or TheMariaSanchezShow.com. It says today's podcast, but if you click on that, it takes you through to a portal where they're all available and or they're individually available. So we've got plenty of resources for you to be able to find us. And find us. Like us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page called The Maria Sanchez Show. Gee, that's creative. And so the more likes, the more we feel like we're liked. So thank you so much for that. We've got our top five news stories that we're going to get into after our first guest this part of the program, which we're going to be speaking with a professor of Spanish who is taking 20 students tomorrow to Cuba. And we're going to talk about that trip and what they have planned. I personally have been there myself. I was there 2 years ago. So I have some perspective on the country, and I want to hear what he has to say about that. And we wanted to share that with you. But over the weekend, had the honor of meeting Michael Phelps, the most decorated Olympian ever, last night, and that was something, I'll share that with you. But on Saturday was the wedding of Bob and Patty, and it was in the afternoon. It was a lovely day. The weather was fabulous here in Southern California. A backyard wedding. They sent out invitations, and they didn't ask for RSVPs, which I think is wow, but Patty's an event planner, so she knows how to figure that stuff out. So how they knew how many chairs to have, I don't know. But there was, I don't know, I would say maybe 50 of us there. And a mutual friend of ours married them, a woman, Dr. Bunny. And they were standing under an arbor. And Patty loves blue, the color blue. So when friends of ours hosted a bridal shower for her last month, they said, please wear some blue. So I had blue toenails, blue fingernails, a blue dress, and blue jewelry. So Patty wore a blue dress yesterday for her wedding. And the invitation also said resort casual attire, or casual resort attire, something like that. So one of the men that I knew that's a mutual friend also said he was going to wear like a coat and tie. And I was like, nope, dude, you can get away without doing that. And he's like, how come? And I said, it said if you paid attention to the attire. So I wore a sundress. And the groom, Bob, had on a pair of flip-flops, Bermuda shorts, and a bowling shirt, and a cap, and sunglasses. And that's how he got married. And it was really interesting. It was refreshing. They have been married before, and they met online. And during the ceremony, Dr. Bunny said, do you have a word for each other? And Patty spoke first. And she said something that I think would be lovely to be able to say. She said, I have never been loved or been taken care of the way you have loved and taken care of me. And I thought, wow, what a great thing to be able to say. And then Bob got the mic and he said, the way I take, and his voice broke and he stopped and everyone starts sniffling because it was like, how sweet is that? That is just so cute. And we're talking folks in their 50s, you know, and it's like love's alive, love's in the air, spring's around. It's people are getting married still in spite of the abysmal prognosis for the success of relationships. But I just think that's fabulous. So fast forward to last night, Michael Phelps, I've been a subscriber for, I think it's 14 years now. It's called the Distinguished Speakers Series. And it's here in Southern California, but there are iterations of it throughout the world and America on sometimes universities, sometimes on city levels, whatever. So if you ever get a chance to participate in something like this, I cannot recommend it highly enough. So the season starts in October and it ends in May. It's seven speakers. They speak once a month, and they're world leaders and newsmakers and politicians and like the Dalai Lama. I saw Walter Cronkite. I mean, it's just been a fabulous experience. And the format is such that the speaker usually speaks for 60 minutes, and then there's 30 minutes of Q&A that the attendees write down on index cards before you go into the arena, the Civic Arts Plaza in this case. There's one in Pasadena, one in Redondo Beach if you're in Southern California. And then the moderator asks the guest those questions. Well, last night they varied a little bit, and they had the main MC come out, and then he introduced this sports writer, basically, who's co-authored books with athletes, including Michael Phelps, who sat down in a chair, and then there was a coffee table in between him, and then Michael Phelps came out and spoke. Now, keep in mind, this man is going to be 28 next month. He was born on June 30th, 1985. So prior to that, there was a private reception where we got to do the meet and greet and got a picture taken with him, which I posted on Facebook. He is just a specimen, a human specimen. First of all, he's absolutely adorable. He's handsome. And he's, I think, 6'4", they said, 6'3", maybe, and he weighs like 200 pounds. He said that when he swam in the London Olympics that he was a little thin. He was 185 then. Can you imagine on that frame and all that muscle? So he is the most decorated Olympian of all time with a total of 22 medals. He also holds the all-time records for Olympic gold medals. That's 18, which is double the second highest holders. He has the all-time records for Olympic gold medals in individual events, Olympic medals in individual events for a male. He won 8 gold medals at the 2008 Beijing Games, and he took the record for the most first-place finishes at any single Olympic Games. And it goes on and on, and I'm sure you're very familiar with him. But something that I learned last night is that after the Summer Olympics in 2008, he started the Michael Phelps Foundation, which focuses on growing the sport of swimming and promoting healthier lifestyles. And we've got three stories in today's news about health and wellness and fitness that we're going to share with you a little bit later. But one of the things that I thought was really cute is he said that he got into swimming at 7 because he had so much energy. It helped dispel that energy. Well, when I was looking him up and reading about his accomplishments after last night's talk, it says he was in the sixth grade, he was diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which is in the news today. I'll share a story with you about that later. He didn't say that. All he said is that he had a high amount of energy and it helped him get tired. So he would get tired and then that would help him sleep. So the other thing is that when he did qualify for the 2000 Summer Olympics at the age of 15, he became the youngest male to make a U.S. Olympic team in 68 years. And he didn't win a medal there, but he certainly set himself up for that. And then he speaks very lovingly about his coach, Bob Bowman, and what they did and how they did it. And one of the lessons that he tried to share last night is you can do anything you want to do. You can be anything you want to be. You have to put your mind to it, and you have to decide that that's what you want. And so he would shape these goals, and then he would achieve them. And he was like, I want to be an Olympian. I want to get a gold medal. I want to make world records. And lo and behold, he did. So that was something empowering, I thought, for all of us in the audience, regardless of your age and your accomplishments, that, you know, it's never too late. So we're calling our first guest, who's Dr. Stephen Clark. He is a professor of Spanish at Cal State University, Channel Islands, and he's joining us this morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Dr. Clark. Welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for the invitation. I'm glad to chat with you.
Me too. Now, I'd like you to share with our listeners about this program for the travel course experience that you've got going, and then we'll go into the details about the trip itself, please.
Sure. Well, at CSU Channel Islands, part of our mission statement is to give students international and multicultural perspectives. And so professors are encouraged to develop courses that involve an international travel component. And the university provides funding for these trips that subsidize two-thirds of the cost, and that comes from a fee called Instructional Related Activities Fund. Students contribute to that, and then professors apply in the most interesting and educational and academic-related trips are chosen, and we started this about a year ago, this process of preparing this course, and so we've offered it to students taking my course, which just ended, which is Cuba in Literature and Film, and my colleague's course in the program of Chicano Studies called Culture, Cuban Culture, Politics, and History, Professor Alamillo in the Chicano Studies program. So we selected 10 students from each course, and they had to apply for the travel experience, and we selected the students, and we're heading off tomorrow as sort of a culminating experience for those two courses, building on what the students have learned in the classroom through readings and films and the like, and now they're going to get a first-hand experience in Cuba Today, which is the title of the course. So that's how it basically came about, and we're really looking forward to it.
How did you choose the students? What was your criteria?
Well, we were very fortunate in that we only had 20 spaces,
because
the university could only provide funding for 20 students, and both of our courses have a total of around 20 students, so we had about 40 students, and we only had 20 spaces. But as luck would have it, I guess the stars aligned, we got 10 applications from each class, and they all were really good students, and so we didn't have to turn anyone down.
Nice.
So it was just almost preordained that it was going to work out. So we're just delighted that everyone who wanted to go got to go, and they submitted a real good application, and so we're leaving tomorrow.
Now, you leave tomorrow from LAX, and how are you getting to Havana?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because when we started this out, there were direct flights from LAX to Havana, which is one of the reasons that made this trip so attractive. And the problem was, in February, once we had everything approved and were basically finalizing everything, the company that flies from LAX to Havana decided there wasn't enough demand, and so they canceled that flight. There's no more direct flights from LAX from anywhere in California, I believe, to Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to change that to flying from LAX to Miami and then from Miami to Havana. But that was going to throw a monkey wrench into the works, too, because we didn't have funding for a night in Miami, which you can imagine is pretty expensive. And so we ended up having to take the red eye. And so we're going to take the red eye tomorrow night, get to Miami, and about 6 in the morning on Wednesday, and then leave for Cuba Wednesday afternoon, which, of course, cost us a day because we were expecting to leave during the day. And so we had to juggle everything around, but it eventually worked out. But we're taking a charter company from Miami.
Now, I've been to Cuba. I went 2 years ago, and I went with a religious philanthropic organization that was approved through, the Department of Treasury, actually. And folks who are listening, how is it that you got 22 people approved to get to go to Cuba? How did that work?
Yeah, that's an interesting process as well, because as you know, Americans cannot really go to Cuba on their own very easily due to the embargo. But since President Obama took office, the policy towards educational, cultural, academic travel has changed, and now if you are enrolled in a course for academic credit through an accredited university in the United States, and that course has a component in Cuba, then you are permitted to travel to Cuba along with the faculty and staff of the university, and that's considered under the license for academic travel through the Treasury Department, and we just had to get our provost to sign off saying all these students are actually Channel Island students enrolled in the course, and that way we were able to make the reservations with an authorized travel agent that is allowed to make Cuba-U.S. travel under the restrictions of the embargo for journalists, academics, Cuban-Americans, and the people in the categories that are allowed to go. So we're very fortunate. We were a bit on pins and needles during the election, because a lot of these academic, cultural-type exchanges can go, come and go depending on who's in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
So that was fortunate that we didn't have to wait until, you know, the policy changed again or got reversed. So we're very fortunate to be able to go.
And Professor Clark, have you been before?
Yes, I've been many times because I actually did my doctoral dissertation on Cuban literature, and I wasn't able to go as a graduate student. I did my doctoral dissertation on literature of Cuban exile writers, but once I finished my doctorate, started working as a professor, I said, well, now it's time for me to see the other side of the coin, and I need to go to Cuba and start to interact with writers who are living in Cuba. And so I started that in 1999 and went every year for 4 or 5 years, and then this is the first time I'll be back in a few years, and the first time I've ever gone with students. So that should be a real eye-opening experience for them, as it was for me the first time I went.
And I'm sure nothing has changed since I was there, since nothing has changed in 50 years. What was your takeaway after your first visit there and the subsequent ones?
Yeah, I think probably like most people, the first trip, you're very excited because it's almost like traveling back in time,
mm-hmm.
and it's sort of a Cold War time warp, and the first impressions are very stunning of the old cars and the colonial facades and the crumbling, beautiful yet crumbling architecture in Havana. But as you go back again and again, that's the one thing that strikes you, is that things don't seem to change much at all, and a lot of the people there are desperate for finding a way to improve their day-to-day existence, despite the gains that the revolution has made in areas such as education and healthcare. There seems to be a bit of a sense of ennui or existential boredom and desperation for when are we going to improve and join the first world in everyday life, such as internet access and freedom of speech and things like that. So to me, it became a bit, you know, depressing to go back and see everyone always in the same job that they had been on my first trip, and whereas in the U.S. we're always thinking about a certain job as a stepping stone to my next job and improving your state in life. So that's one thing that really struck me, but that also goes back to the Cuban Revolution philosophy of being content with your station in life and not always looking for your next promotion. But at the same time, I think our students will get a lot out of it, in that this is the country that probably is the closest to us that we know the least about. So
mm-hmm.
getting them to interact with people that, a lot of our students are Hispanic, but they have a lot closer ties to Mexico and other areas in Latin America. I think there's probably only one or two students in our university of Cuban or Cuban-American descent. So it should be a really good experience for them to see what life can be like in a country that really has very, very little in common with us in terms of the political or economic system that we're used to.
Well, one of the things that I was struck by is that you hear about Cuban rum, Cuban coffee, and Cuban cigars. And my understanding when I was there was that the best tobacco is exported, the best coffee is exported. The rum, there's one and only rum, the Seven, Siete, I guess is what they call it. So that even the largesse of their country, they can't appreciate and enjoy, and also the cost involved with consuming those products is prohibitive for many. So while we were thinking we were having great Cuban coffee, and they're saying, yeah, this is the dregs, the best beans get shipped out, so that, because that's how they make their money in their trade. And I found that true outside. When we left Havana, we went to this area where they're self-sustaining and they're trying to be, you know, living off the land and solar and all this sort of thing. We drove for like 2 hours through these verdant, fertile, the earth just looks like it's so ready for crops, and it's line fallow. And
mm-hmm.
it's like, why is there hunger when you've got the land here and you can grow and feed yourselves? I didn't understand any of that.
Yeah, that's one of the greatest paradoxes of Cuba. It's one of the most fertile soils in the world, and yet due to the mismanagement of the economy, they haven't been able to to take advantage of that to feed their people. And it basically goes back to the planned economy with price controls. And so the price controls are designed to make sure people can afford the food. But if people can't produce the food and make a profit, mm-hmm. then they're not going to produce it. And so, you know, it's almost the government shooting itself in the foot because they want to make it affordable, but if people aren't going to make money producing it, it's not going to work. So there's a lot of changes recently you may have read in the government sort of recognizing that they need to modernize this planned economy, and now people can actually buy and sell houses and cell phones, computers, DVD players, microwaves, even cars, and there's a lot more freedom in terms of making a small business, you know, within the very limited resources that they have, such as nail salons, hair salons, taxis, and just selling little odds and ends out of your front porch there. Cubans are allowed to travel off the island now. They can run family restaurants with less restrictions in the past. And so there's a general awareness on the government's part that the economy wasn't working and they need to improve things. But a lot of the critics say this is too little too late. But on the other hand, people say, some other analysts are saying that once the people get a little taste of this economic freedom, they're going to demand more political freedom as well. And so a lot of people are hopeful that these first initial limited steps towards economic autonomy for the working class could end up in really changing Cuba for good, as far as becoming a more free economy and a more free political system. You're right, it's very confusing to see such a fertile place not able to feed its people.
Well, and what I also didn't understand is, okay, there's an experiment. I understand you're patient. 10 years, 20 years, but exactly. 50 years, it didn't work. It's not working. It's, you know, like you said, the buildings are crumbling. Those cars are from the 50s with now, I guess they have Japanese motors inside them, but they're mm-hmm. still tooling around, the Chevrolets and all. And it was just like, wow, when do you start and say, okay, well, we really need to readdress this, because obviously this is not okay.
Yeah, and I think that's the question a lot of people ask. The Soviet Union was around 70 years or so. Cuba's over 50, and so hopefully we're getting to the end of that cycle, and it'll no longer be sustainable. But at the same time, I think biology is going to play a big role in that. The generation that fought the revolution and overthrew Batista, they're now in their 80s, mm-hmm. and they're still in charge. And they're not going to be in charge for much longer due to Father Time. And at the same time, I think everyone realizes that the next generation, even if they're appointed by these charismatic, almost legendary, mythical figures like Fidel and his brother Raul and their comrades in arms, even if they have appointed their successors, as they have done to some extent, they won't have the hold on the society that the creators of the revolution did, just because they weren't the ones who fought it firsthand. And so people are a lot of analysts are thinking that basically we're at the end of the road in the next few years due to the fact that these people won't be around any longer. So that's another cause for optimism,
for celebration,
given that generational change is coming.
Now, what do you think about how Raul has handled it since his brother passed on?
Well, he's a lot more pragmatic in terms of realizing that things aren't going well in terms of the economy, and the reforms he's made are a manifestation of his pragmatic nature. And at the same time, he's under the influence of his brother to a certain extent, mm-hmm. and that probably won't allow him to be as pragmatic as he might like to be, just because that shadow is still in the mm-hmm. background there. And even though Fidel's not in charge, I think it's just a matter of almost pride amongst that inner cadre of revolutionaries. They don't want to admit that it hasn't worked. And I think in basic human terms of saving face or refusing to acknowledge their mistakes. And so that might be another reason that the generational change will be will be a great catalyst to improving life, because the new generation, I don't think they'll have those same qualms about saying, you know, things weren't working, it's time for a change.
Good. Now tell me what you're going to be doing with the students. Where are you going to go and what are you going to see?
Yeah, we've got a really interesting itinerary. We start with basically the historical sites and cultural landmarks in the city, you know, the museums and the old plazas and the colonial architecture. But then we're going to get into a little bit more of daily life for Cubans by visiting farmers markets, which have benefited from these new economic reforms. We might be traveling to that same area that you went to outside of the country. We're going to a province west of Havana called Pinar del Rio, which is where they grow the tobacco. And we're going to be seeing a sustainable farm there. We're going to visit some schools. We're going to visit some clinics to learn about their healthcare system, some artist studios. We're going to visit a very interesting experimental artist studio where Down syndrome young people create artwork and sell that and gives them sort of a purpose in life, and a cigar factory, sporting venues, dance and musical venues. And we're going to be meeting with some Cuban experts in economics and politics and culture. And so we're going to try to give the students some free time also to interact, you know, with young people that they might meet at the different clubs that they might go to in the evening to listen to music and things like that. So,
what about Hemingway's house? Are you going to go to Hemingway's house?
Oh, yeah, that's on our agenda, yeah, too.
That's mm-hmm. a nice little snatch of history there, too.
I enjoyed that. And that shows you how close America and Cuba was for so many years. Mm-hmm. One of our greatest writers, he lived and wrote most of his greatest works in Havana.
And the nightclub, is it the Coco Cabana?
Well, we have an optional trip to the Tropicana.
Tropicana, thank you. Yes, I went there to the mm-hmm. show. That was something. I was surprised at how risque it was for such a, you know, uptight society or culture. It's quite the performance.
Yeah, actually in the Caribbean, in Cuba in particular, the attitude towards, risque behavior is a bit more relaxed than we might be used to here in the U.S. And we made that optional in case there's students who wouldn't be comfortable with that. But that's basically the basis for a lot of the nightclub shows in Las Vegas, because before there was a Las Vegas, people went to mm-hmm. Havana.
Yeah, they talked about that, Frank Sinatra. They would go from Miami and spend the night and then fly back the next morning, I guess. And mm-hmm. even President Kennedy, and et cetera. It was the Hollywood's playground, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Clark, thank you for your time, because I know you've got to be incredibly busy. You just graduated students. You had finals, and now you're leaving tomorrow on a red eye, which I don't – I'm not looking forward to it for you. I flew in on a Sunday night, spent the night at the hotel at the airport in Miami. And then we took a plane out Monday morning, so ours was a little more civilized. But I understand because of your budget constraints.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to it, and hopefully we can get our finals graded, and we'll be ready to go tomorrow.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for taking your time. I do appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot, Maria.
You're welcome. Travel safely, too. Dr. Clark with Cal State University Channel Islands, taking students 20 to Cuba starting tomorrow with his colleague. We're going to be right back in just a moment. We're going to talk about the news, and then we've got another guest who is the winner of the Strawberry Festival's cook-off over the weekend. We'll be right back.
Show is killer. You won't believe it's all.
Yeah. Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez. We used to play that at the opening of our program every morning. I've been in radio for 21 years, and I've had all kinds of shifts. I had weekend shift first at KFI, and then a fill-in shift for the great legendary folks at KFI, and then got my own program in Sacramento, California, which is in Northern California, and that shift was from 9 a.m. to noon, and then had a stint on NPR, and that was an hour program called Crosstalk. So that was in the after. No, that was in the morning too. That was an hour, like from 9 to 10 a.m. Then had a morning drive program that was 6 to 9 a.m. That was my happiest. And people were like, why? And I said, because I was up at 3 every morning doing my prep and then getting to the station and doing more prep and then going live. What I love about the mornings, I've been a morning person my whole life, but aside from that, 3 o'clock in the morning is not normal for anybody. I don't think you ever get adjusted to it. But I have that same feeling with this program, is because I'm up at 5:30 prepping. It's like, what am I going to learn today? What am I going to find out about today? And with the morning show, people's morning habits are pretty cast in stone, and so they are creatures of habit, and so they have these cycles, and you're able to share with them what they missed while they were sleeping and while they were showering and et cetera, et cetera. You kind of keep them company. And then I had a afternoon drive program from 3 to 6 p.m. in the afternoon. That's not as regulated in terms of people's habits as the morning is. So just thrilled and tickled to be back on the radio again. And a shout out to the Ventura County Star. They mentioned our program briefly, and I think it was called Business Briefs yesterday in the Sunday paper. And I got a couple emails from friends who were like, hey, Maria, and I hadn't seen it. I do subscribe. It gets on my driveway every morning. Yep, I'm one of those still, even though I get my news off the net. Because, and speaking of, when we went on the air this morning, the lucky person who entered the public supermarket in recent days and purchased the winning Powerball ticket worth over $590 million had yet to present themselves. So the earliest they can come forward is today, because Florida's lottery headquarters in Tallahassee is closed over the weekend. And under state law, the winner's name, age, and hometown will be made public after turning in the winning ticket. So the winner gets to decide whether to take an annuity or a lump sum. The lump sum comes out to $371 million, because the lottery withholds 25% to pay federal taxes. There's no state tax in Florida, which means that somebody could walk away with $278 million after taxes. So if they decide to receive the lump sum, they must claim that within 60 days of the drawing. And if they decide to take it in installments, they can wait up to 180 days. So Zephyr Hills is the town where the public supermarket ticket was sold. It has a population of 13,000 people. So, and the odds of winning were 1 in 175 million, and I had every intention of buying 5 tickets, one for me and for my 4 children, and I flippin' forgot. So you can't win if you don't buy a ticket. So congratulations to somebody that is going to have $278 million after taxes. So also in the news in terms of money is the founder of the blogging site Tumblr. Yesterday, Yahoo's board of directors agreed to buy his blogging platform, which has 100 million users and 90 million posts per day, for $1.1 billion in cash. He's 26 years old. David Karp is his name. He founded the Tumblr in his mom's Manhattan apartment in 2007. Tumblr is a micro blogging platform. You can quickly post pictures, text, and video, and also functions as a social media site. Tumblr has a young demographic, 18 to 34-year-olds, and that's the reason that the new CEO of Yahoo, Marissa Meyer, wanted to snatch it up, because she says that that's how they're going to attract a younger audience, too. Tumblr also has an amazing loyalty among its users. Some 85% of Tumblr users make 20 or more posts a month. And it is also popular with many porn stars and features numerous sexually explicit blogs. The founder, David Karp, is a high school dropout. Now, that is kind of a misnomer, because what I have discovered is that his parents let him drop out of high school at age 15, and he completed the remainder of his education by homeschooling. So it's, you know, but this kid obviously was very bright. He taught himself code HTML at 11 years of age. At 17, he moved to Japan, where he nailed down his skills as a programmer. He moved back to New York and worked as a consultant. He founded Tumblr in 2007 at age 21. He started up an office in Manhattan and has resisted moving to California and the Silicon Valley. We could use the proceeds from the sales of your income tax here in California. And so, of course, we don't know how much he owns of the company, because in 2008 he sold a 25% stake to investors for $750,000. So look at that return on their investments, the angel funds or the venture capitalists. There is a really tragic story in the news today. A 21-year-old Hofstra University junior was killed Friday night in a home invasion. She is a twin. She shared the off-campus rental house with her twin sister and two other students on Long Island, New York. There was Dalton Smith, 30 years old, is the suspect. He entered the home when someone went outside to move a car about 2 a.m. on Friday morning. They offered up their watches, their jewelry, their cell phones, their computers, and he wasn't satisfied with that. So he sent one of Andrea Rabella's roommates to an ATM to get cash. Fortunately, she called 911. They dispatched two officers. When they came in, they found that the Dalton Smith was holding Rabello in a headlock at gunpoint. And when the suspect pointed the gun at the officer, they exchanged rounds. 8 rounds were fired from the officer. 7 of those struck the intruder. 1 hit Rabello and killed her. They were both dead. So unfortunately, it's such a sad story. So the officer who fired the fatal shot hasn't been identified publicly. He is currently on sick leave because of this incident. He spent about 12 years on the force in Nassau County, and he had previous experience as a New York City police officer. Andrea Rabello's funeral is scheduled for Wednesday in Sleepy Hollow, New York. So here, this is health news now that we've got in front of us. Boys who are diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, in elementary school, of which Michael Phelps was when he was in the sixth grade, are more likely to grow up to be obese adults than those who don't have the condition. And you'd think it would be because they're so active that they would be thin. So researchers surveyed two groups of 41-year-old men and found those with a history of ADHD were 19 pounds heavier than their non-ADHD counterparts. So the study also said that the men that were surveyed who had a history of ADHD and the men who didn't have ADHD, the men who had ADHD had a 41% chance of them being obese versus 22% for those who did not have ADHD. And that was contrary to the study's team's hypothesis. They found that men who no longer had their childhood ADHD symptoms were especially likely to be obese, not those who still had persistent ADHD problems. So according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, parents report that close to 1 in 10 kids and teenagers has been diagnosed with ADHD. Boys are more than twice as likely to be diagnosed as girls. And I have 4 children. My third child is a son, and that word was never spoken in the parent-teacher conferences, but everybody sure danced around it. And my son was a distraction to himself, not to others. It wasn't that he probably had a version of ADD, but they wanted, that was in the Ritalin days. And I was like, nope, I'm not doing it. We're going to figure this out. We're going to make it work. And we did. And then he ended up taking some medicine as a freshman in high school, not Ritalin, but we had a neuropharmacologist test his brain. And he studies the alpha, beta, the delta, and the theta rays of the brain. And he diagnosed medication to get them to respond the way they're supposed to. And he says he doesn't care what or how you came into his office, just the fact that he studies the chemistry of the brain. And so that was a science I could get behind. So that's, and so Christopher did that just, I don't know, he may have done it for about 6 months to a year. And now he's 23 years old and he's getting his bachelor's of music degree because he's a composer and a performer, and it's a good story. So here's one last health story, and then we have to get to our next guest, who's Larissa Nelson, who won the Strawberry Festival's cook-off yesterday. The Strawberry Festival was over the weekend in Oxnard. It's a huge event here in Southern California. If you are fit and you exercise, this latest study, which is going to be shared later next month at a convention, says that you are less likely to develop lung or colon cancer, and if you do, the most fit were significantly less likely to die of prostate cancer, colon cancer, lung cancer. So they studied men, and they said that there's similar indications with women. So those who were the most fit were 68% less likely to develop lung cancer and 38% less likely to develop colon cancer 20 years later. And if the men did develop the cancer, those who were the most fit were significantly less likely to die of the prostate, colon, and lung cancer. So they did their fitness measuring something called MET, a metabolic equivalent of task. And one MET is sitting on the couch. So they do treadmill tests and they study. But so here's the good news. So they have shown that exercise lowers the risk of cancer, but this one is one of the first to show it can also reduce the risk of dying from cancer. So there's been more than 50 studies involving 40,000 people, and they have found that people who exercise regularly have a 40 to 50% lower risk of colon cancer, and women who exercise at a moderate to vigorous level for more than 3 hours a week have a 30% to a 40% lower risk of breast cancer. So we can't help our genetics, but we sure can help how, and our age, but we sure can help how we take on the world. So that's just another good news story, which we try and focus on as much as possible, because there's enough bad news in the world. So now we're going to call Larissa, and she is going to visit with us about what this experience was like with the Strawberry Festival and how it was that she was declared the winner.
Hello.
Hi, Larissa Nelson. Good morning. You're on the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you for making yourself available, and congratulations.
Good morning, and thank you.
So if you can briefly go through the process of how you went from submitting a recipe and deciding which one to submit, and then the cook-off, and how you were one of the last five, and then the competition itself over the weekend, please.
Sure. The Strawberry Festival every year does a cooking competition, and they invite you to submit a recipe that involves strawberries and a creative use of strawberries. And so I kind of thought about a few of the things that I wanted to make and would sound good to me. And one of my favorite desserts is tiramisu. And so I thought, well, how can I make it a summer dessert and incorporate strawberries? And strawberry tiramisu is not necessarily a unique thing. It's been done before. But one of the things that I have been using a lot lately is the coconut. And so I thought, oh, if I incorporate coconut milk, then maybe this will make a good dessert. So I tried it, and it worked. And I liked it, so I said, okay, I'm submitting this recipe. So I picked the recipe, you submit it online, and then you just wait. And about 2 weeks later, I got a call, and they said, okay, you're one of the finalists, and you want to come compete in a bake-off. So then from there, you go to a bake-off with five top finalists. It's at the Oxnard Marriott Kitchen. It was really fun, actually. There was, you know, five people. There was someone from Idaho that came, that drove in for the competition. There was, you know, people from L.A. It was really fun. It's just a fun cooking experience where we were all competing against each other, but doing it, you know, lightheartedly. And so then they had judges there, and those judges that also came from all over tasted the dishes and picked the top two finalists. And then the top two finalists, which was me and Winona, we both competed yesterday or Saturday for the final prize of the competition. And I was lucky enough to be the winner.
Now, they did the judging at the festival differently this year. Is that correct?
You know, I'm not sure, actually. I think
because there
done
used
it.
To be, you know, the People's Choice, where they would pass out samples, and then they said the health system said that they couldn't do that. So you had five judges on Saturday?
Yeah.
Okay.
I had five judges. Yeah, I wasn't sure if they did the People's Choice in the past or not. I know that they did samples for more samples in the past, but the actual contestants made, but this year the contestants didn't make, but I think they still had the same judging process with the judges.
Now, did you create your recipe, or you tinkered with one? So you made it up yourself? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, tiramisu is a pretty basic in terms of a layered dessert dish, and most traditional tiramisus include mascarpone cheese. I actually thought about maybe including cream cheese instead of mascarpone because it's a little easy to find, but I think mascarpone kind of gives it that extra special good taste. And so, kind of, you know, I just tinkered with a few different ingredients of a basic tiramisu, and then added my added some different things. Like a regular tiramisu includes coffee, so I didn't want to do coffee in my dessert. I'd use coconut milk instead to soak the ladyfingers in, and I've never seen that done before. And used toasted coconut in the layers, so that was kind of my idea of incorporating something new into a tiramisu. And then, you know, of course, lots of chopped fresh strawberries in the layers, which was, I think, and actually one of the judges did say that that kind of put it over the top of the other recipe because they didn't taste the strawberry enough in the other recipe. Mm. It was incorporated, but it wasn't, you know, kind of one of the standout ingredients. So,
now, what are the constraints for presenting your dessert, both at the bake-off and then on Saturday? Is there a time limit, and is there
you had an hour to complete the dessert, an hour to complete it. At the festival, we had a little camp burner that we used. You're not using a stove. You're not using an oven. You're not using any other, you know, big fancy utensils. Basically, anything that you could take camping with you.
And
but you didn't know when you actually submit the recipe, they don't tell you necessarily that's how it's going to be. But
oh.
It worked out.
Now, how nervous were you?
You know, I wasn't nervous at all. Actually, I really enjoy cooking, and my competitor is a fun lady, and we just kind of, you know, we just had fun. So I wasn't nervous until the last 5 seconds when they were going to announce the winner. That's when I got nervous.
And what do you win?
We win a cruise, yeah.
So
I won a cruise, and you can choose to go to, I think it was Baja, Florida, or the Bahamas. So hopefully my husband will agree to go with me, and he gets seasick. So.
I was going to say, that's not a long shot, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And then why don't you let our listeners know about what happened on Saturday with your coconut?
With my burnt coconut. Mm-hmm. I knew it was going to happen. I had my ex, and the funny thing is the part of the recipe that I wanted to do is I wanted to toast coconut, and I normally have always only toasted coconut in the oven, where I just stick it in at 350 for like 5 to 10 minutes, and that's the easiest way to toast coconut. But you can do it on the stove as well, but you have to literally watch it every second. So if you're being distracted, which you do in a cook-off because you're talking to the judges and you're talking to the moderator, it can burn easily. So actually in the finals, which was the one that was the first one with the 5 finalists, my coconut burned when I was there. And then on Saturday, my coconut burned as well. But I prepared for it, and I had extra coconut, and I was able to do another batch. Because basically I was just distracted talking to people and not watching it as closely as I should. So if you do try the recipe at home, just watch that coconut or do it in the oven, and you won't have any burn problems.
Now, did you have to make 5 amounts or okay, so each judge gets their own serving. I'm sorry,
mm-hmm. It was 6 servings that you made.
6 servings, okay.
Judges and one taster.
Mm-hmm. And how did you share it? Did you put it into a cupcake tin or something?
I actually did. I don't know if you've seen the food trend with the mason jars. So I was using the mason jars, and it looked really good. I actually used the mason jars as a cookie cutter to cut my ladyfingers to size, so they fit perfectly into the mason jar. And I think it would be a fun way to do other desserts as well, using pound cake and, you know, Cool Whip and things like that. So that was a fun little way to present the dessert, I thought.
Well, I just learned this morning doing the prep that there's 2 young men that have made mason jar cocktail shakers.
Ah.
Because they used to use that in college, they said, and so now they've attached a little top and the sieve part so that you can strain out drinks, and apparently they're selling out and they're you know, going gangbusters. So there you go with your mason jars. You're cutting edge. Did you know?
Yes, I did. I was hoping to be. I just saw like a mason jar sippy cup for adults where there's this little lid that you screw onto a mason jar and you can sip your drink out of it.
Oh, so tell me, Larissa,
there's a lot of stuff.
The recipe, how can one avail themselves of your recipe?
You know, I thought it was going to be posted on the Star in the past. They've posted the recipes on the Star website, but I haven't seen it there yet, so I'm not sure.
So if you will share it with me, I'll post it on our website.
Okay. Yeah, I'll give it to you. I'll send it to you, and you can post it. That would be great.
Perfect. Larissa, thank you, and congratulations. It's a great story. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Maria. It was fun. And anyone else out there, you can do it, so try entering next year.
There you go. Take care. Larissa Nelson, she was the winner of the cook-off at the Strawberry Festival, which was held over the weekend. And I was headed to Oxnard to go to the wedding on Saturday, forgot that the festival was there. Caltrans had signs to, you know, getting you off the freeway and all that stuff, and it was, wow, was it crowded. It was bumper to bumper, so it's very well attended, and it's something that we want to help promote next year. So next, tomorrow we have our medical correspondent visiting with us. He's going to speak about Angelina Jolie's decision to have the elective double mastectomy. He's going to be visiting with us tomorrow. And we also have the world's only astrosexologist visiting with us tomorrow because the signs of the zodiac are changing. Hope you have a great day. Thank you so much for joining us. Look forward to the honor tomorrow morning.
Thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.